Eliza Merritt knew very little of books. Indeed, she was barely literate. But when she saw how keenly Dr. Minor collected and cherished his old volumes, and when she listened to his querulous remarks about the delays and costs of the postal service between London and Crowthorne, she made an offer to collect his orders for him and bring them down on her visits. And so it happened that month after month, Mrs. Merritt began delivering packages, wrapped in brown paper and sealed with twine and wax, from the West End's great book emporiums like Mag's, Bernard Quaritch and Hatchard's. The delivery system, such as it was, probably remained in place for only a few months. Mrs. Merritt eventually took to drink and apparently lost all interest in the curious and eccentric unfortunate. But the system appears, during its brief life, to have led to what was undeniably the most serendipitous event in William Minor's otherwise melancholy life. For it was in the early 1880s that he stumbled across the first of James Murray's famous appeals for volunteers, which asked for interested parties to indicate that they might be prepared to work on the new dictionary. Murray first published his appeal in April 1879, and had 2,000 copies of it printed and circulated by booksellers. One would almost certainly have found its way, probably fairly soon after its distribution, into one or more of the packages that Mrs. Merritt brought to Minor at the asylum. The 8 pages explained in very broad terms what was likely to be wanted. First, there were Murray's own suggestions for the kind of books that needed to be read. In the early English period, up to the invention of printing, so much has been done and is doing that little outside help is needed. But few of the earliest printed books, those of Caxton and his successors, have yet been read, and anyone who has the opportunity and time to read one or more of these, either in the originals or accurate reprints, will confer valuable assistance by so doing. The later 16th-century literature is very fairly done, yet here several books remain to be read. The 17th century, with so many more writers, naturally shows still more unexplored territory. The 19th century books, being within the reach of everyone, have been read widely, but a large number remain unrepresented, not only those published during the last 10 years while the dictionary has been in abeyance, but also of earlier date. But it's in the 18th century above all that help is urgently needed. The American scholars promised to get the 18th century literature taken up in the United States, a promise which they appear not to have any extent fulfilled, and we must now appeal to English readers to share the task, for nearly the whole of that century's books, with the exception of Burke's works, have still to be gone through. After this, Murray listed rather more than 200 specific authors whose works, in his view, were essential reading. The list was quite awesome. Most of the volumes were rare, and likely to be in the hands of only a very few collectors. Some books, on the other hand, were already available at Murray's newly established dictionary library at Mill Hill. They could be sent to readers who promised to do work on them, and vouched to return them, I might point out. When Henry Furnival had been editor, he found that a number of disgruntled readers used the lending scheme as a means of swelling their own library collections, and neither sent in the requested quotation slips nor ever returned the books. Dr. Minor was clearly in one of his more scholarly, reflective, and positive moods when he read the pamphlet, for he responded with alacrity and enthusiasm. He wrote to James Murray almost immediately, formally volunteering his services as a reader. It's not wholly clear, though, just when this was, not clear exactly when Minor first started his legendary work. Murray recalled later that he had received Minor's letter very soon after I commenced the dictionary. No correspondence between the doctor and the dictionary has been traced, however, until 1885, which is hardly very soon. But one clue exists. There had been an article in the Athenaeum magazine in September 1879 suggesting that Americans might like to become more keenly involved, and it's quite probable that Minor, who is known to have subscribed to the magazine in Broadmoor, would have seen it. Based on this assumption, on Murray's recollections, and on the records of Minor's contributions that have lately been unearthed in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, it seems probable that his relationship with the dictionary got underway in 1880 or 1881. But where did James Murray think his correspondent was living, and what did he think he did? Murray said that he remembered only that the first and subsequent letters from Minor had been addressed to the dictionary office simply from Broadmoor, Crowthorne, Berkshire. Murray was too busy to ruminate on the matter, no matter how curiously familiar the address might have been. By the time he read Miner's first letter, he'd already received about 800 similar letters in response to his appeal. He was being swamped by the success of his entreaty. He replied to Miner with his characteristic courtesy, saying that on the basis of his apparent qualifications, enthusiasm, and interest, he should start reading immediately, going through any of the volumes he might already have, or else looking to the dictionary office for copies of books he might require. In due course, Murray continued, the doctor could expect to receive particular word requests, in the particular event that the dictionary editors had trouble finding quotations for a specific word on their own. For the time being, however, Dr. Miner and all the other early respondents to whom the editor expressed his considerable gratitude should just start reading and should start making word lists and writing quotations in a careful, systematic, but general way. Two additional sheets of printed paper Murray was enclosing with the letter, which underlined a formal agreement that Dr. Miner had been officially welcomed as a volunteer reader, would offer any necessary further advice. But through all this, James Murray explained some years later, I never gave a thought to who Miner might be. I thought he was either a practicing medical man of literary tastes with a good deal of leisure, or perhaps a retired medical man or surgeon who had no other work. The truth about his new American correspondent was a great deal stranger than this detached, innocent, and otherworldly Scotsman could ever have imagined. Entering the lists. Catchword. Noun. In printing, the first word of the following page inserted at the right-hand lower corner of each page of a book below the last line, now rarely used, or a word so placed as to catch the eye or attention, specifically the word standing at the head of each article in a dictionary or the like. The supporting quotation from 1879, Directions to Readers for the Dictionary, put the word as a catchword at the upper corner of the slip. The two small, closely printed sheets that came as an addendum to Murray's first letter turned out to be a set of meticulously worded instructions. When his morning mail was delivered by the ward staff that day, Miner must have fallen upon this one envelope eagerly, reading and rereading its contents. But it wasn't the content alone that fascinated him. A list of rules for dictionary helpers was not the cause of his excitement. It was the simple fact that they had been sent to him in the first place. The letter from James Murray represented, in Miner's view, a token of the further forgiveness and understanding that Eliza Merritt's visits to him had already suggested. The invitation seemed a long-sought badge of renewed membership in the society from which he had been so long estranged. By being sent these sheets of rules, he was, he felt, being received back into a corner of the real world, a corner that admittedly was still housed in a pair of cells in an alien madhouse, but one that had firmly forged links to the world of learning and connections with a more comfortable reality. After a decade of languishing in the dark slough of imprisonment, intellectual isolation and remove, Miner felt that at last he was being hoisted back up onto the sunlit-up plans of scholarship. And, with what he saw as this re-enlistment in the ranks, so Miner's self-worth began, at least marginally, to re-emerge, to begin seeping back. From the little evidence that survives in his medical records, he appears to have started recovering his confidence and even his contentment, both with every moment that he spent reading Murray's acceptance letter, and then when he prepared to embark on his self-set task. For a while at least, he seemed truly happier. Even the sternly worded Victorian ward notes of the day hint that the temper of this usually suspicious, broody, prematurely elderly-looking middle-aged man, he was now approaching 50, had somehow started to turn. His personality was undergoing, even if only for a short while, a sea change, and all because, at long last, he had something valuable to do. Yet in its very value lay a problem, as Miner saw it. The doctor swiftly came to realize, and was daunted by the realization, the simple fact that this great work's immense potential value to history, to posterity, and to the English-speaking world, meant that it had to be done properly. Murray's papers had explained that the dictionary was all about the gathering of hundreds of thousands of quotations. It was a task that was almost unimaginably vast. Could it be done from an asylum cell? Minor was both wise enough to understand and ask himself the question, since he knew very well where he was and why he was there, and then, in a partial answer, to applaud Murray for having taken the right approach to the work on which he was about to embark. Minor's own love of books and literature gave him some knowledge of dictionaries, and an appreciation of what was good and what was not so good about those that had already been published. So, on reflection, he decided that, yes, he very much wanted to work for the project and to be a part of it, not solely because it would give him something worthwhile to do, which was his first reason, but mainly because, in his opinion, Murray's plan for doing it was so self-evidently right. But Murray's plan meant that there was clearly going to be much more to Minor's cell-bound duties than the mere enjoyment of a blissful and leisured romp through the history of published English literature. Minor needed now to pay absolutely scrupulous regard to what he read, to trawl religiously for whatever happened to be needed by Murray's team, and eventually to select from the cod of his net the very best possible entries to send away to be included in the book. Murray's notes showed him how best this might be done. The quotations, said the editor's first page, were to be written on half sheets of writing paper. The target word, the catchword, as Murray liked to call it, was to be written at the top left. The crucial date of the quotation should be written just below it, then the name of the author and title of the cited book, the page number, and finally the full text of the sentence being quoted. Pre-printed slips had already been prepared for some books that were important, well-known and likely to be used a great deal. Familiar works by such as Chaucer, Dryden, Hazlitt and Swift. Readers assigned to these books needed only to write to Mill Hill to have some scent. Otherwise, Murray asked them to please write out their own slips in full, arrange them alphabetically, and send them on back to the scriptorium. All this was simple enough, but everyone wanted to ask just what words were to be sought out. Murray's early rules were clear and unambiguous. Every word was a possible catchword. Volunteers should try to find a quotation for each and every word in a book. They should perhaps concentrate their efforts on words that struck them as rare, obsolete, old-fashioned, new, peculiar, or used in a peculiar way, but they should also look assiduously for ordinary words as well, providing that the sentence that included them said something about the use or meaning of each word. Special attention also needed to be paid to words that seemed to be new or tentative or obsolete or archaic, so that the date could be used to help fix the moment of each one's introduction into the language. All that, Murray hoped, was surely plain enough. But then again, asked would-be readers, how many quotations should be supplied for each word? As many as convenient, Murray wrote back, especially where different contexts tended either to explain differences in the meaning or help to illustrate the subtle variations in a particular word's usage. The more quotation slips that came into the iron shed he had built in Mill Hill, the better. He assured readers that he had ample supply of assistance to sort them out, and that his floors had been especially strengthened to hold them. More than 2 tons of slips of paper had already come in from Coleridge and Furnival's first efforts, Murray added, but he didn't allow as to how many of them had been nibbled at by mice or ruined by damp, nor did he reveal that one batch was found in a baby's bassinet, or that a load of slips beginning with the letter I had been left in a broken-bottomed hamper in an empty vicarage, or that the entire letter F had been accidentally sent off to Florence, or indeed that thousands of slips were so poorly handwritten that, Murray reported to a friend, it would have made for easier reading if they'd been written in Chinese. The second sheet of notes seemed to Minor at first to offer rather more practical, if much more prosaic, help. It first made clear that Murray had a fund from which he could repay the postage to those volunteers who sent packages of slips but couldn't afford to do so. And it asked further that the packages be sent to Mill Hill by book post, with their ends unsealed, so that Murray didn't have to pay fines for those that had been shut with even the tiniest bit of adhesive, which was forbidden by post office regulations. Many early readers turned out to be dreadfully confused. They simply didn't understand the scope of their allotted task. For example, asked a couple of them, did every single use of the word "the" with any one book require an illustrative quote? There'd be tens of thousands from any volume before any of the substantive words were even begun. And further, wailed one of the women readers, what if one had ploughed through all 750 pages of a volume, just as she had, and found not a single rare word to extract? Murray's notes offer a tolerant and genial enough response to this kind of complaint, though a faint sense of his Calvinist asperity glimmers between the lines. No, he spoke through moderately gritted teeth, there really was no need to offer scores of illustrations for definite articles and prepositions, unless the circumstances turned out to be very strange. And no, 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 books were not to be scoured for rare words alone. He had to remind volunteers of this fact time and again. Readers must find and note all and any words that seemed interesting or that were quoted in interesting and signifying ways or in ways that were good, apt, or pithy. As an example of the dangers of the process so far, he said he'd received no fewer than 50 quotes for the word abusion, which means perversion of the truth, but had had only 5 for the much more common word abuse. My editors have to search for precious hours for quotations for examples of ordinary words, which readers disregarded, thinking them not worthy of including, he wrote. Think simple, Murray kept insisting. Think simple. And then, half exasperated that he evidently still hadn't been clear enough, he laid down a distilled version of his instruction, a golden rule, a sentence that was to become the dictionary reader's epigraph. He wanted readers simply to be able to say, "This is a capital quotation for, say, heaven, or half, or hug, or handful. It illustrates the meaning or use of the word. It is a suitable instance for the dictionary." Follow that kind of thinking, Murray insisted, and you won't go too far wrong. William Minor read and clearly understood all of this. He looked about his library cells, scanning the volumes in the astonishing collection that he had already accumulated over the previous 10 years. He took out the list of books that had come with Murray's original pamphlet. He'd see first if he had any on his shelves that might in time become useful. All of a sudden, his books, which had hitherto been merely a fond decoration and a means of letting his mind free itself from the grim routines of Broadmoor life, had become his most precious possession. For the time being, at least, he could set aside his imaginings about the harm that people were trying to inflict on him and his person. It was instead his hundreds of books that now needed to be kept safe and away from the predators with whom he believed the asylum to be infested. His books and his work on the words he found in them were about to become the defining feature of his newly chosen life. For the next 20 years he'd do almost nothing at Broadmoor except enfold himself and his tortured brain in the world of his books, their writings, and their words. He was maverick enough, original-minded enough, however, to realize that he could do better than simply follow Murray's orders to the letter. Given his peculiar position, his leisure, his library, he could do more, do otherwise. It took him some days of pondering exactly how he might best serve the project, but after some weeks of thinking, he came up with what he thought was the best way to tackle the task. He made a decision. He took down from his shelves the first of his books and laid it open flat on his reading desk. We cannot be sure which book it was. For the sake of illustration, though, let us say the first volume, and which we know he had and used, was a leather-bound, gold- and marble-edged translation of a French book called Complete Woman by one Jacques Dubosc. Published in London in 1639, it had been translated by a man identified only as N.N. His arguments for starting with this in particular, and indeed for reading it at all, were many. It was a good 17th-century work. It was obscure and exotic. It was filled, no doubt, with strange and amusing words. After all, Murray had exhorted his volunteers to examine this specific period of literary history. The 17th century, with so many more writers, naturally shows still more unexplored territory, he'd written. Dubosc's book, in its anonymous translation, fitted the bill splendidly. So, Minor took from a drawer 4 sheets of white paper and a bottle of black ink, and he selected a pen with the very finest nib. He folded the paper into a quire, a booklet 8 pages thick. Then, with perhaps one last glance down from his cell window at the lush countryside below, he settled in to read his chosen book, line by line, paragraph by paragraph, with slow and infinitely measured care. As he did so, he began a routine that he had planned during his early days of preparation. Each and every time he found a word that piqued his interest, he wrote it down in tiny, almost microscopic letters, in its proper position in the quire he had made. This unique manner of his procedure was soon to become a hallmark of Miner's astonishing accuracy and eye for detail. His work would win the admiration and awe of all who were later to see it. Even today, the choirs preserved in the dictionary archives are such as to make people gasp. Let us choose as an example the moment when he came across the word buffoon. He was first struck by the significance of its appearance in a suitably illustrative sentence on Dubosc's page 34. He promptly wrote it down in his tiny, perfectly neat, perfectly legible handwriting on the first page of his blank booklet. He wrote it in the first column and decided to place the word and its page number in the column about a third of the way down. The placement was precise and it was carefully chosen. The reason for this was Miner's certainty that sooner or later he'd find another interesting word beginning with the same letter, B, that there was a very good chance it would have to be put before buffoon, and only a very much slimmer chance that it would need to be put after, because buffoon's second letter being U, there were only three possibilities, finding a further word or words whose second letter was again U, or one with the only other legitimate second letters W, with only one word, buona, or the letter Y. Sure enough, a few pages later, he came across the interesting word bulk, with a nice quotation, and so deserving to be entered in the choir. He placed it on the list above buffoon, but with enough space in the event that another B word came along whose second letter was somewhere in the alphabet between the new A and the old U. 5 pages further on, he then cited with some pleasure the word blab, a word of the very kind he had anticipated, and so in it went, levered into the space that he had so artfully retained below bulk and well above buffoon. And thus did the word list for the first of Dr. Miner's cellful of books begin, word after word after word, each one with its spelling exact, its location in the choir perfectly appropriate, the page number where it was to be found in the source book precise. From atom and azure, to gust and hearten, fix and foresight, the list went on and on. Some of the words occurred many times. Feel, for example, which Miner recorded as cropping up on 16 of Dubosc's pages, although some of these turned out to be feeling, either the gerund, as in I can't help feeling this way, or the noun, as with the feeling of which you speak is painful. It must have taken him many weeks, perhaps months, to complete this first word list. Perhaps it was well into the year 1883 by the time he finished it. But even though fully 4 years had now elapsed since James Murray had sent out his first appeal pamphlet, and more than 3 years since the first nudge to American readers in the Athenaeum magazine, and a year, maybe two, since Miner had read one or other of the appeals and had decided to become involved, he still had not sent one single quotation slip down to the scriptorium. For all the staff of the dictionary knew, Miner had lost interest, become overwhelmed, dropped out. But nothing could have been further from the truth. Dr. Miner, in fact, had quite another plan of attack, a working method that turned out to be very different from that of all other volunteer readers, but that soon marked him as uniquely valuable in the making of the great dictionary. For once he had completed the monumental task of writing his first word list from his first book, he replaced that volume and took down another. Perhaps his next was Francis Junius, The Painting of the Ancients, from 1638, or Thomas Wilson's The Rule of Reason, from 1551, or perhaps something quite different. It could have been any one of hundreds of books, for he had a prodigious collection, and it would be his practice to select one, then another, and then yet another, and write a new word list for each one. One book might take him 3 months to complete, in the kind of detail he felt his distant editors would demand. And so he'd work away, day after day, the tiny spy window in his door clicking open and shut every hour or so from the outside as the Broadmoor attendants checked on the safety and the existence of their strange patient. He'd be working hard, deep in thought and with rapt concentration. He would index and collect and collate words and sentences from each of the books until his prison desk was heavy with the quires of paper, each one containing a master list of the indexed words from his eclectic, very valuable and much valued little gem of a library. Although we cannot be sure which of his books he did read first, we do know the titles of some of the books that he had read. Most of them, it turns out, reflect his keenly forlorn interest in travel and history. One can only imagine how his poor mind must have raced, trapped as it was in his book-lined retreat on the top floor of his cell block. How frustrated and pinioned he must have felt reading line after line of such books as the one by Thomas Herbert, written in 1634, entitled A Relation of Some Years' Travail Begun Anno 1626 into Afrique and the Greater Asia. One can only suspect how homesick Minor must have felt for Trincomalee and his native girls on reading and indexing Nicholas Litchfield's 1582 translation of Fernán López de Castañeda's first book of the history and the discovery and conquest of the East Indies. One by one, his collection of carefully assembled word leaflets mounted up. By the autumn of 1884, he had enough of them, a large enough selection of words for which he had readily accessible quotations, to begin inquiring of the dictionary editors, and Murray himself in particular, which catchwords, precisely, were then needed. For while all the other volunteers would simply read their assigned books, note down interesting quotations on their slips of paper as they came across them, and send them off in bundles, Dr. Minor, with all the time on his hands, was able to extrapolate on his radically different homegrown approach. With his rapidly growing collection of word lists and his indexes, he stood ready now to help the dictionary project as it needed to be helped, by sending over quotations at the precise time the editors needed them. He could keep up, he could be abreast of the progress of the dictionary all the while, because he had ready access to the words that were needed when they were wanted. He had made a key, a Victorian word Rolodex, a dictionary within a dictionary, and it was instantly available. The choirs of lists on his plain wooden table represented an accumulated creation of which he was quite rightly and jealously proud. His practice was first to write to the dictionary and ask what letter or word was then being worked on. Next, on receiving a reply, he would refer to his own index choirs to see if he had already noted down the wanted word. If he had, and given his method and his wide and energetic reading, it was more than likely that he had, he'd follow his own notation of the page number or numbers and go straight to the word's appearance or appearances in one of his books. Then, and only then, he'd transcribe the best sentence containing the word onto a ready-made quotation slip and send it directly to the scriptorium. It was an unprecedented approach, the kind of technique that only someone with an immense amount of energy and disposable time could contemplate. And, of course, it was a technique that suited the editors famously. They knew now that down at this mysteriously anonymous address in Crowthorne, in all probability they had on tap, as it were, a supply of fully indexed words, together with their associated citations and quotations. With the arrival of Minor's first letter, saying what he had done and how ready he was for further inquiry, Murray's hard-pressed staff discovered that life had become, in theory, very much simpler. From this moment forward, they were not obliged only to ferret through their shelves and pigeonholes, and to trawl through thousands of existing slips for quotations that might or might not exist for a word they wanted to include. They could simply decide on a word that was giving them problems, write to Crowthorne, and ask for it. With good fortune, and with a very high statistical likelihood, they would in due course receive a letter and a package from Dr. Minor, giving the precise chapter and verse for whatever was wanted, enclosing the quotation slips at the very instant they were needed to be pasted onto a page for the compositors, the typesetters, and the printers. The first word to be tried in this way was a deceptively simple one, to the extent that any individual word is simple compared to any other. It was a word that was due to be included in the dictionary's second fascicle, or part, being ready to be printed and published in the late summer of 1885. "Please inspect your word lists," wrote a sub-editor, "to see if you can find in them references to the word art and to all its derived forms." The letter went directly to Dr. Minor at Broadmoor, as his invitational letter had suggested. Whichever of Murray's sub-editors first asked him the question, in reply, had no ideas about the man from whom an answer was sought. For many years thence, no one in the scriptorium was to learn anything about him, except for the undeniable truth that he was very good at his job, very quick, and on his way to becoming an indispensable member of the great new dictionary team. Art was to be his first test. Annulated, art, brick tea, buckwheat. Poor. Adjective. Having few or no material possessions. Wanting means to procure the comforts or the necessities of life. Needy, indigent, destitute. Specifically, especially in legal use, so destitute as to be dependent upon gifts or allowances for subsistence. In common use, expressing various degrees from absolute want to straitened circumstances or limited means relatively to station, as a poor gentleman, a poor professional man, clergyman, scholar, clerk, etc. The opposite of rich or wealthy. Poor people, the poor as a class, often with connotation of humble rank or station. Also, such or so circumstances to excite one's compassion or pity. Unfortunate, hapless. The first slips of snow-white, unlined paper, 6 inches by 4, and covered with William Miner's neat, elaborately cursive and so distinctively American handwriting in greenish-black ink, began to drift out from the Broadmoor post-room in the spring of 1885. By the late summer, they were arriving at their destination in small brown paper packets every month, and then larger packets every week. Before long, the gentle shower of paper had turned into a raging blizzard, one that was to howl up from Crowthorne unceasingly for almost all of the next 20 years. The paper slips were not, however, sent to Mill Hill. By the time Dr. Miner had begun to engage in the second stage of his work, contributing the quotations rather than amassing the lists, James Murray and his team had all moved up to Oxford. The editor had been persuaded to give up his comfortable job as a schoolteacher, and despite poor pay and the interminable hours, he had taken the plunge into full-time lexicography. This was in spite of a general mood of malaise and wretchedness. Murray's experiences with the first years of work on the big dictionary were far from happy, and many were the times he had vowed to resign. The delegates at the press were parsimonious and interfering. The pace of work was proving insufferably slow. His health was suffering from the interminable hours, his monomaniacal devotion to an almost impossible task. But then there was one sustaining fact. The first of the fascicles, the revenue-producing instalments into which Oxford insisted that the dictionary be divided, had at last been published on January the 29th, 1884. Nearly 5 years had elapsed since James Murray had been appointed editor. 27 years had passed since Richard Chenevix Trench had given his famous address, in which he called for a new English dictionary. Now, in a muddy, off-white cover, and with its sheets half uncut, was the first part, 352 pages worth, of all the known English words from A to Ant, published by Clarendon Press, Oxford, at a price of 12 shillings and 6p. Here at last was the first morsel of substance, part one of A New English Dictionary on Historical Principles, founded mainly on the materials collected by the Philological Society, edited by James A. H. Murray, LLD, sometime president of the Philological Society, with the assistance of many scholars and men of science. Murray could not help but be proud. The problems that seemed so insuperable and that had so pressed down on him would tend to vanish whenever he held the flimsy paper-covered volume in his hand. And in a sudden sunburst of birthday eve optimism, the editor, he'd be 47 in less than a week, declared that he now felt confident in predicting that the final part would be published in 11 years' time. It was, in fact, to take another 44. But now, after all the years of waiting, the interested world could at last see the magnificent complexity of the undertaking, the detail, the filigree work, the sheer intricacies of exactitude that the editors were bent on compiling. Those in England could write and receive a copy for 12 shillings and 6p. Those in the United States received a fascicle printed in Oxford, but published by Macmillan in New York, for $3.25. The first part's first word, once the 4 pages devoted to the simple letter A had been accounted for, was the obsolete noun R, meaning a stream or a watercourse. There was a quotation supporting its existence from a work of 1430, which had a reference to the still rather damp and water-girt Lincolnshire town of Saltfleetby, in which, 4 centuries earlier, there had been a rivulet known locally as Le Seven Town R. The first properly current word in the fascicle was aal, a Bengali or Hindi name for a plant related to the madder, from which a dye could be extracted and used to colour clothes. Andrew Ure's 1839 Dictionary of Arts, Manufactures and Mines provided the authority. "He has obtained," Mr. Ure wrote, "from the aal root, a pale yellow substance, which he calls morindin." And then the first properly English word, if a linguist might quibble, there ever is such a thing. It was to be aardvark, the half-armadillo, half-anteater that lives in sub-Saharan Africa and has a sticky 2-foot tongue. Three quotations are offered, the earliest from 1833.